Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
For thousands of years, the salmon has been an integral part of our world. But as with so much of the living world, the past 200 years have changed the very nature of life itself. Struggling now for its survival with the help of an increasing number of dedicated individuals, the common sense of communion is beginning to make a difference. We continue our journey when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Our in-depth journey of the Chinook continues with Charles Hudson.
The first massive dam on the Columbia was Grand Coulee, which to this day is one of the largest dams in the world. It cut off the migration of fish up into Canada. That was followed by dam after dam after dam on the Columbia and Snake Rivers and many tributaries, to the point now where only about a third of what had once been productive salmon habitat remains. Roughly two-thirds of salmon habitat that existed in the Columbia Basin, a region about the size of France, about a third remains viable for salmon survival.
And I'm just curious then, it is a six-state area that is served by the Columbia. The tributary draws from at least that region as well as Canada.
The Columbia Basin includes parts of actually seven states and two Canadian provinces. It is the most lucrative hydropower-producing river in the world. It provides some navigation. There's no question that some dams can provide multiple societal benefits, and I think some tribal people will be among the first to tell you that some dams can provide benefits. But in that orgy era of dam building in the 40s, 50s, 60s, right up into the mid-70s, there were many dams that were built that were poorly conceived. We are dealing with those today in a big way as salmon populations are now declining, have been declining rapidly since the last of these dams went in. Many of them were built for very narrow-minded purposes. In the case of the Snake River dams, there were four large projects put in simply to get a few barges up and down the Snake River and turn a small Idaho town into functionally a seaport some 600 miles from the ocean. Those dams are lethal to salmon in the Snake River, one of the most promising and previously productive salmon producing rivers in the world.
One typically doesn't think of native reliance on salmon that far inland because it's lost from our memory. And I have to wonder what happened to those cultures as dams went in and suddenly that salmon was eliminated because the dam was there. What are there stories that you can share?
Well, the effects, and again, this is a story of national, where there are national similarities where people have been dislocated, their primary food supply cut off. A lesser known element of the loss of salmon was the reality that what had happened to the Plains Indians cut off the buffalo, kill the buffalo, cut off the food supply, and you can subjugate the Indians, and that horrible dynamic played itself out in the Columbia River in the 20th century. The thing about salmon. We have lost in this world countless species, countless flora, countless fauna. The thing about salmon, and the one that makes it such a politically hot issue and such a tumultuous geopolitical issue, is that salmon have a very strong commercial value. They've always had a great value to native people, but they continue to have very strong commercial value to the non-Indians as well. It is pitted access to salmon culture against culture, and in the 40s and 50s, one of the stakeholders that was happy to see dams go in were commercial fishermen in other parts of the Columbia River, because if the feeling was build a dam, you will cut off tribal access to their fishing grounds. So tribal people were up against a real tough suite of adversaries in the fight to keep the Columbia River and the tributaries ecologically secure. The loss of fish is pretty well documented. Historically, back in the days pre-Lewis and Clark, approximately 16 million fish every year entered the mouth of the Columbia and spawned in any number of tributaries. Over the past 20 years, the average has been about 1.5 million fish. They are just a remnant of what they once were. In the farther you get up the river, the more the problem compounds. And it's an absolute truth that each dam compounds the problem. When you get farther the river, fish are expected to survive the effects of 8 and even 9 dams. It's a very tough challenge. On their best day, they have a 1% chance of actually completing their life cycle.
In terms of the upriver dams, how many of them have fish ladders?
Most of the lower dams have fish ladders. As fish move up the Columbia River, after 9 dams, the 10th dam they encounter is called Chief Joseph Dam. Ironically, one of the great salmon chiefs in the Columbia Basin, the great chief, as first chief, Chief Joseph, there is a dam named after him, and it has no fish ladder. That is up in north central Washington. As a fish would move up the Snake River, it encounters 8 dams before it runs into what's called Hell's Canyon Dam in Hell's Canyon on the Snake, and that has no fish ladder. So that is functionally the end of the line for fish. Areas above those dams were once very productive for sockeye, summer Chinook, fall Chinook. Now fish simply cannot get there and are left to we're left to protect the available spawning area below. You had earlier asked about the impacts of the loss of fish. Quite frankly, many of those impacts are still being identified. There was no doubt that there has been great cultural effects of the loss of fish, and not just the loss of fish from the diet, but the loss of fishing opportunity as a means of perpetuating culture. It's a known fact that the act of fishing was one of the most elemental relations between fathers and sons, wives, brothers, grandfathers, grandmothers in the Columbia Basin. In the act of fishing, it was a communal family activity. Everybody had a particular job to do. There was an understanding that each person needed to play a role in the act of going to the fishing site, fishing, the encampment, the preparing of fish, the appropriate spiritual preparation, once the fish were harvested, the blessing of the fish, the actual processing, gutting, drying, smoking, curing of the fish, and preparing it for the home, preparing it for for trade, preparing it for spiritual ceremonies. It took everybody in the family and the clan to participate in the act of fishing. Once fish went away and the opportunity to fish went away, all of that broke down, and families on the Missouri River and the Columbia and Snake River fell into disarray. All of the basic building blocks of their family structure, their communal structure, evaporated as the fish vanished. On top of that, the absence of fish from the table, the number one staple in the diet in the Columbia, was fish for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. When that food left the picture, left the table, it had to be replaced by something. And sadly, it was often replaced by federal food programs, very high fat, high starch, high sugar, high salt alternatives. That is still playing out in Indian country. The detrimental health effects of losing traditional foods has resulted in elevated diabetes, obesity, heart disease, incidence of cancer,
You made such an interesting point. It's subtle and yet fundamental. You said that the process of hunting itself, now we're going to go back to literally the catching of the fish, was a strong bonding element between fathers and sons, but as well, I'm sure, it had a lot to do with literal physical stamina, mental ability, mental acuity, et cetera, which is the central point of life itself. Discuss some of the traditional ways in which fish were literally taken.
Fish were harvested in any number of ways. Most commonly, tribal people gathered at waterfalls, large waterfalls, small waterfalls. That was a place where fish would be forced to wait, to pause, to gather their strength to move up the waterfall farther upriver. A typical tribal fishing site is what is called a scaffold, and that is a wooden platform, or sometimes it's simply just a place on a rocky outcropping at a waterfall where a long dip net, or what's called a dip net or hoop net, or even a gaff hook could be reached down into the water, and fish would either swim into them, or in the case of a gaff hook, a fisherman would lower it, and fish, keep in mind, were so plentiful that if you dipped your gaff hook into the water, though you couldn't see because of the turbulence of the water at a waterfall, you could feel fish bumping up against it. And a fisherman would simply put the gaff hook down, wait for that bump, and pull up and hook a fish. But the most typical method was with the what's called a dip net, and that would be a small hoop with a net on the end of a long pole. And that net would be lowered into the river, very long, you know, 20, 30 foot long pole, and then just moved slowly because it requires great upper body strength and balance to move it into very strong current. And then when you feel the weight and the tug, you would know that there would be a fish, and then it would be pulled up quickly to your perch.
And that is my point, and thank you. It maintained literal physical strength and acumen to be able to do that, which then was spread throughout the tribe, I have to believe, you know.
And it also, I don't want the point of it being a communal activity to be lost here, because at a waterfall, there's not room for 10,000 people all at one time. There may be 40, 50, 100 good fishing positions available at a site like that, and it was very much shared. There are wonderful stories about the inherent and built-in limits of families, that how they shared a resource and how they never used more than they absolutely needed, and that families would construct, for instance, a box of a particular size that represented the family's fish needs for the year. And when that box got full, then they were done. They weren't looking for the biggest fish, the best-looking fish. They were simply looking for the right number of fish that would sustain them over the course of the year. The term sustainability is obviously enjoys great modern use. It was sustainability in a practiced way.
Well, and that's where we started out, and that is that many of the truths that you were talking about it in the early stages of this, we're becoming aware of them ourselves, this relationship of ourselves to nature itself. Well, amazingly enough, the story continues, and the Bonneville Dam was built ultimately in, I think, the 1930s, and as well other dams up the river, but as well these treaties that existed that maintained the rights of Columbia River Native Americans to fish along the rivers was maintained. Give us a sense of how that developed through those years, and then this will kind of help us to understand what's going on now.
Well, after the dams were built, the region was plunged into some very dark, a dark period around, I would call it societal change. There were, Americans will know, the war years ensued in the late 30s through the 40s, and followed by the Korean War. Dynamics of war, of growth, all have been brought to bear on the Columbia River, on the river itself, on the salmon resource. The need for power, the absolute greed, quite frankly, to get the cheapest power available has plagued the Columbia River and the effort to keep fish and salmon viable, to keep water quality as pure as it can be. The tribal people often tell the story that when they fished on their fishing platforms, there would be, as well as a dip net on a net at the end of a pole, there would be a small can or gourd on another pole that could be dipped into the Columbia River and water and drank directly right out of the Columbia. There's not a tribal person living today that would dare drink the water out of the Columbia River. It has become too contaminated, and that's another fight that is being fought by the tribes, is to restore the Columbia River to a drinkable form. And that is one that's playing out in many, many watersheds around our world, is the desire to bring water quality back to the form it once was, and that is, in its simplest way, drinkable. The era of dam building, great development. Cities have grown. The population of the Pacific Northwest has grown. One of the stories we don't talk about as much, but it is certainly a major factor in the decline of fish, is the enormous degradation of habitat, of deforestation, of the conversion of natural landscapes into agricultural zones. All of these have caused water quality in particular to degrade, that is, to add more sediment into the rivers, and compounded by dams. A free-flowing river has a natural ability to cleanse itself to some extent. A dammed river does not. Sediment toxins that enter the river simply enter a pool as opposed to a free-flowing river and settle down into the sediment base of the river. As well, the spawning areas, fish need clean, clear water. They need gravel. They need clean gravel to carve out a nest, lay their eggs, and then cover those nests up with gravel again. When you deforest an area in a watershed, each rain brings silt sediment into the river, and the gravel, the clean gravel, is more and more scarce in the Columbia River. This is a story that is being repeated in many, many river systems and watersheds throughout the Pacific Rim, and as well now in Asia, in the Kamchatka and Sakhalin Island, places we know that are great producers of salmon, Alaska. Deforestation, this similar erosion of habitat, deforestation has degraded river quality, spawning ground viability, and certainly has happened in Oregon and Washington and Idaho and in Canada. That's another fight. So the problems are incremental. The problems are compounding. It would be unfair to say it's all the dam's problem. It is a complex suite of things that have hurt the fish. The water temperatures, because of deforestation, the loss of what is called riparian buffers, that is the rich growth of trees and willows alongside small streams and tributaries. When that's taken away, water is exposed immediately to the sun, to solar rays, and it begins getting warmed up at the highest elevations. When you do that, when you compound that problem, now water in the Columbia Basin is as much as 20 degrees higher than it was in its pristine state. Salmon can thrive in water up to about 68 degrees Fahrenheit. There are many, many, many days now in the year when water temperature in the Columbia Basin exceeds 68 degrees and is high at times as the high 70s, and even gets into the low 80 degrees in some places in the lower river. That is, while it may not be immediately lethal, every day, every minute a fish spends in water higher than 68 degrees, its life essentially is at risk. Even if it survives to get to the spawning grounds, its biology, its physiology may be so affected that it may not be able to actually complete its life cycle and spawn before it dies.
For many, many, many reasons, you are working in a broad context to do something to turn this enormous story around and to minimally restore and maintain the native people's rights and capacity to catch fish. But that's diminishing every year. The salmon season is being diminished all along the West Coast because of the lack of salmon. What can you tell us about the status of salmon in the last, let's say, 5 or 10 years? What's happening to their populations?
Well, there's good news and bad news out there about salmon restoration. Some of the good news is salmon are the most studied species on the face of the earth. There have been countless millions of dollars spent studying salmon, some for legitimate reasons, some for not so legitimate reasons. We know an awful lot about the life cycle of salmon. We know what they need. We know what hurts them. There are fewer and fewer secrets about what fish need to effectively restore them. There are some new wrinkles, of course, and some very big wrinkles, like the effects of climate change. Effects climate change will have on snowfall and rainfall in these large river systems. We know that we've got new challenges associated with salmon management due to climate change. We also know that there are many mysteries and always changing circumstances in the oceans, and those are things we have very little control over. We can't force the ocean to adjust to any really man-made need. We simply have to adapt to what the ocean provides us. The other bit of good news is that there remains a strong core of both communities devoted to salmon, both from as commercial fishing families, Alaskans, Canadians, people of the Pacific Northwest. There's a very vibrant sport fishing community. There's a very strong and active conservation community who understand that salmon are among the most resilient of species on Earth, and that they may be surviving in spite of all the disrespect paid to them, the destruction of their habitat, the degradation of their water quality, the exploitation of them as a commercial resource. There is a strong community out there who fight simply for the fish, who don't care if they catch one or not. So salmon have an awful lot of friends. What's working against them, however, is the lack of political courage often to do the things necessary. We know what the science tells us. The science has been clear for many years what needs to happen. There needs to be some major modifications to river systems, including taking out several very destructive dams, some that provide very little societal benefit, some that will cost much more to simply maintain than they will ever provide in societal benefits. Some of those really need to be looked at as candidates for removal. And in fact, their removal could do wonders in helping restore these species. There's also a need to reconnect the average citizen, primarily in the western United States, with where their power comes from, how it's derived, and what it does, what damage it does to the environment. There's a general awareness, but industry has been very, very skilled at often portraying salmon as the enemy to cheap power, and we believe that's a false choice, that good businessmen simply won't rely on exploiting and degrading natural resources to provide a cheap product, that we can and must do better. So we have a job to let people know that dams indeed do kill salmon. Dams, though, indeed provide reasonably low-cost power to much of the western United States. But there's a point where we can't simply choose cheap electricity over the continued existence of a species. And that really is one of the things we're going to have to face societally and politically, is does the Endangered Species Act mean anything? Will we allow a species to go extinct for our convenience, or because saving it may inconvenience us a bit? We don't want the latter to happen.
We have heard for years about the complexity of the web of nature, but now nature itself is caught in a complex web of humanity. Will it survive? Stay tuned.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.